The problem now facing me was that of the hardcore recidivists, who were undoubtedly guilty of murder or its attempt. There were five of them facing the courtroom now, wary and resentful. Three of them I recognized at once from the melee in the mess hall. Kelp was the huge, over-muscled man I'd seen being stabbed, and Trebek, to my complete lack of surprise, was the petite woman who had almost disemboweled him. They stood at opposite ends of the row of prisoners, glaring at one another almost as much as at Pargita and myself, and if it hadn't been for their manacles, I had no doubt they'd be at one another's throats again in a heartbeat. In the center was the young trooper I'd seen stab the provost with a broken plate. His data file told me his name was Thomas Hollenby, and I'd had to look twice to make sure it was the same man. He was short and skinny, with untidy red hair and a face full of freckles, and he'd spent most of the trial looking bewildered and on the verge of tears. If I hadn't seen his fit of homicidal rage for myself, I would hardly have believed him capable of such insensate violence. The real irony was that he was a medical orderly, not a frontline soldier at all. Between him and Trebek was another female trooper, one Griselda Vallade. She was stocky, brunette, and clearly out of her depth as well. The only one of the group to have killed a fellow trooper, she had claimed throughout that she'd only intended to fend him off. It was an unlucky blow that had crushed the fellow's larynx and left him to suffocate on the mess room floor. Pargita, needless to say, hadn't bought it, or cared whether she intended murder or not. He just wanted as many Valhallans in front of a firing squad as he could manage. On Hollenby's other side was Maxim Sorrel, a tall, rangy man with short blonde hair and the cold eyes of a killer. Sorrel was a sharpshooter, a long-lass specialist who snuffed out lies from a distance as dispassionately as I might swat an insect. Of all of them, he was the one who most threw a scare into me. The others had been carried away by the bloodlust of a mob and hadn't really been responsible for their actions past a certain point, but Sorrel had slid a knife through the joints of a provost's body armour simply because he hadn't seen any reason not to. The last time I'd looked into eyes like those, they'd belonged to an elder homunculus. "If it was up to me," Pargita said, continuing, "I would have the lot of you shot at once." I glanced down the line of prisoners again and noted their reactions. Kelp and Trebek glared defiantly back at him, daring him to make good on the threat. Hollenby blinked and swallowed rapidly. Vallade gasped audibly, biting her lower lip, and began to hyperventilate. To my surprise, I saw Hollenby reach across and give her hand a reassuring squeeze. Then again, they'd been in adjoining cells for weeks now, so I suppose they'd had time to get to know each other. Sorrel simply blinked, a complete lack of emotional response that sent shivers down my spine. "Nevertheless," the captain went on, "Commissar Kane has been able to persuade me that the commissariat is better suited to maintaining discipline among the Imperial Guard, and has requested that they be permitted to pass sentence according to military rather than naval regulations." He nodded cordially to me. "Commissar, they're all yours." Five pairs of eyes swiveled in my direction. I stood slowly, glancing down at the data slate on the table in front of me. "Thank you, Captain." I turned to the trio of black uniformed figures sitting at my side. "And thank you, Commissars. Your advice in this case has been invaluable to me." Three solemn heads nodded in my direction. This was the trick, you see. My earlier contact with the other commissars on board had unexpectedly paid off, showing me who would be the most easily swayed by my arguments. A couple of eager young pups just past cadet, and a jaded old campaigner who had lived most of his life on the battlefield. And all of them flattered from here to Terra to be taken into the confidence of the celebrated Caiaphas Kane. I turned back to the prisoners. "A commissar's duty is often harsh," I said. "Regulations are there to be obeyed and discipline to be enforced. And those regulations do indeed prescribe the ultimate penalty for murder, unless there are extenuating circumstances. Circumstances, I have to admit, I have striven to find in this case to the best of my abilities." I had them all on the hook by now. The fans in the ceiling ducts sounded almost as loud as a chimera engine. And to my great disappointment, I have been unsuccessful. There was an audible intake of breath from practically every pair of lungs present. Pargita grinned triumphantly, sure he'd got the blood vengeance he lusted after. However, I went on after a fractional pause. A faint frown appeared on the captain's face and a flicker of hope on Valade's. As my esteemed colleagues will undoubtedly agree, one of the heaviest burdens a commissar must carry is the responsibility to ensure that the regulations are obeyed not only in the letter, but the spirit. And it was with that in mind that I took the liberty of consulting with them about a possible interpretation of those regulations which I felt might offer a solution to my dilemma. I turned dramatically to the little group of commissars, taking the opportunity to underline that it wasn't just me cheating Pargita out of his firing squad, it was the commissariat itself. Again, gentlemen, I thank you. Not only on my behalf, but on behalf of the regiment I have the honour to serve with. I turned to Castine and Brocklaw, who were observing proceedings from the side of the courtroom, and inclined my head to them too. I was laying it on with a trowel. I don't mind admitting it, but I've always enjoyed being the centre of attention when that doesn't involve incoming fire. A commissar's primary concern must always be the efficiency of the unit to which he is attached, I said. And, by extension, the battlefield effectiveness of the entire Imperial Guard. It's a heavy responsibility, but one we are proud to bear in the Emperor's name. The other commissars nodded in sycophantic self-congratulation. And that means that I'm always loath to sacrifice the life of a trained soldier, whatever the circumstances, unless it's the only way to win His Glorious Majesty the victories he requires. I assume that you're eventually going to come to a point of some kind, Pargita interrupted. I nodded, as though he'd done me a favour instead of disrupting the flow of an oration I'd been practising in front of the mirror in my stateroom for most of the morning. Indeed I am, I said. And the point is this. My colleagues and I, no harm in reminding everyone again that this was a carefully contrived consensus, not just me, see no point in simply executing these troopers. Their deaths will win us no victories. But the regulations, Pargita began. This time it was my turn to cut him off in full flow. Specify death as the punishment for these offences. It just doesn't specify immediate death. I turned to the line of confused and apprehensive prisoners. It's the judgment of the commissariat that you all be confined until it becomes expedient to transfer you to a penal legion where an honourable death on the battlefield will almost certainly befall you in the fullness of time. In the interim, should a particularly hazardous assignment become available, you will have the honour of volunteering. In either case, you can expect the opportunity to redeem yourselves in the eyes of the Emperor. I raked my eyes along the shabby little group again. Kelp and Trebek, their truculence mitigated by surprise, Hollenby still bewildered by the sudden turn of events, Valade almost sobbing with relief, and Sorrel, still that blank expression, as though none of this mattered at all. Dismissed! I waited until they'd shuffled out, assisted by the shock batons of the escorting provosts, and turned back to Pargita. Will that satisfy you, Captain? I suppose it'll have to, he said sourly. Congratulations, Commissar. Castine raised a glass of Amasek, toasting my victory, and the mess hall erupted around me. I smiled modestly, walking towards the table occupied by the senior officers, while men and women clapped and cheered and chanted my name, and generally carried on as though I was the Emperor himself dropping in for a visit. I half expected some of them to try patting me on the back, but respect for my position, or an understandable reluctance to get too close to Jürgen, who was dogging my heels as usual, or both, held them in check. I held up my hands for silence as I reached my seat between Castine and Brocklaw, and the room gradually fell quiet. Thank you, all, I said, injecting just the right level of barely perceptible quaver into my voice to suggest powerful emotion held narrowly in check. "You do me too much honour for just doing my job." A chorus of denial and adulation followed, as I'd known it would. I waved them to silence again. "Well, if you insist." I waited for the gale of laughter to die down. "While I have everyone's attention, and that's a refreshing novelty for a political officer..." More laughter. I had them in the palm of my hand now. I waved them to silence again, adopting a slightly more serious mien. "I would just like to offer some congratulations of my own. In the short time I've had the privilege of serving with this regiment, you have all far exceeded my most optimistic expectations. The past few weeks have been difficult for all of us, but I can state with confidence that I have never served with a body of troops more ready for combat and more capable of seizing victory when that time comes." With confidence? Certainly. Truthfully? That was another matter entirely. But it had the desired effect. I picked up a glass from the table and toasted the room. "To the 597th, a glorious beginning." "The 597th!" they all shouted, men and women alike, swept along with cheap emotion and cheaper rhetoric. "Nicely done, Commissar," Brocklaw murmured as I sat. The cheers were still deafening. "I believe you've turned us into a proper regiment at last." I'd done something a lot more important than that, of course. I'd established myself as a popular figure among the common troopers, which meant they'd watch my back if I was ever careless enough to find myself anywhere near the actual combat zone. Pulling them together into an effective fighting force was just a useful bonus. "Just doing my job," I said as modestly as I could, which is what they all expected, of course, and they lapped it up. "And not before time," Castine added. I kept my features carefully composed, but felt my good mood begin to evaporate. "We've had our orders?" Brocklaw asked. The colonel nodded, picking at a Radovan salad. "Some backwater dirt ball called Gravelax."
"Never heard of it," I said.
Editorial note. Given Kane's complete and typical lack of interest in anything that doesn't concern him directly, the following extract may prove useful in placing the rest of his narrative in a wider context. It must be said that the book from which it comes isn't the most reliable of guides to the campaign as a whole, but it does, unlike most studies of the Gravelax incident, at least attempt to sketch in the historical background to the conflict. Despite the author's obvious limitations as a chronicler of events, his summing up of the casus belli is substantially correct. From Purge the Guilty, an impartial account of the liberation of Gravelax, by Stententious Logar, 085.M42.
The seeds of the Gravelax incident were sown many years before the full magnitude of the crisis was realized, and in retrospect, it may well be easy to discern the slow unfolding of an abhuman conspiracy over the span of several generations. A historian, however, has the perspective of hindsight, which, alas, cannot be said of the actual participants. So, rather than pointing an accusatory finger with righteous cries of how could they have been so stupid, it behooves us more to shake our heads in pity as we contemplate our forebears blind stumbling into the very brink of destruction. It goes without saying that no blame can be attached to the servants of the Emperor, particularly those concerned with the ordering of His Divine Majesty's fighting forces and the diligent adepts of the Administratum. The Ultima Segmentum is vast, and the Damocles Gulf an obscure frontier sector. After the heathen Tau were put in their place by the heroic Crusader fleet in the early 740s, attention rightly shifted to more immediate threats. The incursion of High Fleet Leviathan, the awakening of the accursed Necrons, and the ever-present danger from the traitor legions, not least among them. Nevertheless, the Tau presence remained on the fringes of Imperial space, and, all but unnoticed, they began once again to encroach on His Divine Majesty's blessed dominions. Up until this point, Gravelux had been an obscure outpost of civilization, barely noticed by the wider galaxy. Enough of its land masses were fertile to keep its relatively sparse population tolerably well fed, and it possessed adequate mineral reserves for such industry as it supported. In short, it had nothing to attract any trade, and an insufficient population base to be worth tithing for the Imperial Guard. It was, to be blunt, a backwater, devoid of anything of interest. If Gravelax thought it was to remain undisturbed indefinitely, however, it was sadly mistaken. Within a century of their drubbing at the righteous hands of the servants of the Imperium, the black-hearted Tau were back, spreading their poisonous heresies through the Gulf once more. When they first chanced upon Gravelax, no one knows, but by the turn of the last century of the millennium, they were well established there.
837.M41, according to surviving records. Like many amateur historians, Logar is long on rhetoric and short on actual scholarship.
It will come as no surprise to my readers, aware as we must be of the innate treachery of all aliens, that they had arrived at this pass by an insidious process of infiltration, and, shocking though it is to record it, with the willing assistance of those whose greed and thoughtlessness made them the perfect dupes of this monstrous conspiracy. I refer, as you have no doubt already guessed, to the so-called rogue traders. Rogues indeed, who would place their own interests above those of the Imperium, humanity, and the Divine Emperor himself.
Several paragraphs of inflammatory but non-specific denunciation of rogue traders omitted. Logar seems to have had something of an obsession about their untrustworthiness. Perhaps one owed him money.
How and why these pariahs of profit first began trafficking with the Tau, history does not record.
Or Logar couldn't be bothered to do the research.
What is certain is that Gravelax, with its isolated position on the fringes of Imperial space and close to the expanding sphere of influence of these malign aliens, became the perfect meeting place for such clandestine exchanges. Inevitably, the corruption spread. As trade increased, it became more open, with Tau vessels becoming a common sight at the new and expanding starports. Tau themselves began to be seen on the streets of the Gravelaxian cities, mingling with the populace, tainting their human purity with their soulless alien ways. Heresy began to run rife, even ordinary citizens daring to use blasphemous devices, unblessed by the tech priests, supplied by their insidious off-world allies. Something had to be done. And at last it was. The rising stench of corruption eventually attracted the ceaseless vigilance of the Inquisition, which lost no time in demanding the dispatch of a task force of the Imperium's finest warriors to purge this festering boil in the body of His Holiness's blessed domain. And that's precisely what they got. For in the vanguard of this glorious endeavour was none other than Caiaphas Kane, the martial hero at whose very name the enemies of humanity trembled in terror. Chapter 3. Old friends are like debt collectors. They have a tendency to turn up when you least expect them. Gilbran Quayle, Collected Essays. As I've rattled around the galaxy, I've seen a great many cities, from the soaring spires of Holy Terror itself to the blood-choked gutters of some Eldar Reva charnel pit, but I've seldom seen anything stranger than the broad thoroughfares of Myo, the planetary capital of Gravelax.
Kane was part of the invasion force which cleansed Sanguir. His account of this action is also recorded in the archive.
We disembarked in good order, the freshly sewn banner of the 597th snapping proudly in the breeze that blew in gently across the rock-crete hectares of the starport as the Valhallans formed up by company, and I resisted the temptation to lean across and compliment Sula on her needlepoint. I doubt that she'd had anything to do with procuring it, but it wasn't that which dissuaded me. She just wasn't the kind to take a joke, and was still harbouring a germ of resentment at the organisational changes I'd instituted. We were a fine sight to behold, I have to admit, the other regiments glancing at us sidelong as they marched away, although that may just have been surprise when they realized we're a mixed unit.
It was hardly unprecedented for men and women to serve together in the Imperial Guard. Notable units in which this was the norm included the Omicron Rangers, Tanith First, and Calderon Rifles. However, with women making up fewer than 10% of the total number under arms, and the vast majority of those serving in single-sex regiments, it wouldn't be that surprising if the 597th excited a certain amount of curiosity among the onlookers present.
All present and accounted for, Colonel. Brocklaw snapped a drill manual salute and fell into place beside Castine. She nodded, inflated her chest, and then hesitated on the verge of giving the command. Commissar, she said, I think the honour should be yours. This regiment wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for you. I don't mind admitting I was touched. Although I have overall authority in whatever unit I'm attached to, commissars are always outside the regular chain of command, which means I don't really fit in anywhere. By letting me give the order to move out, she was demonstrating in the most practical form imaginable that I was as much a part of the 597th as herself, or Brocklaw, or the humblest latrine orderly. The unaccustomed sense of belonging choked me for a moment, before the more rational part of my mind started gloating about how much that would mean in facilitating my own survival. I nodded, making sure I looked suitably moved. Thank you, Colonel, I said simply. But I believe the honour belongs to us all. Then I filled my chest and bellowed, Move out! So we did. And if you think that sounds like a simple proposition, you haven't thought it through. To put it into some kind of perspective, a regiment consists of anything up to half a dozen companies, five in our case, most of which had four or five platoons. The exception was Third Company, which was our logistical support arm and consisted mainly of transport vehicles, engineering units, and anything else we couldn't find a sensible place for on the SO&E. All told, that came to much the same thing in a headcount. Factor in five squads a platoon at 10 troopers each, plus a command element to keep them all in line, and you're looking at nearly 1,000 people by the time you've added in the various specialists and the different layers of the overall command structure. Just to add to the confusion, Castina decided to split the squads into 5-man fire teams, anticipating that any open conflict was likely to take place in and around the urban areas. Beating off the Tyranids on Karania had convinced her that smaller formations were easier to coordinate in a city fight than full-strength squads.
A widespread, though unofficial practice among units experienced in urban warfare, so much so that it's now become part of the standard operating procedure in many regiments, the ad hoc arrangement persisting to become a permanent feature of their organisation.
All this made for a fine martial display as we moved out, you can be sure, with banners flying and the band thumping and parping away at If I Should Forget Thee, O Terror, as though they had a grudge against the composer. There hadn't really been time for rehearsals, what with all the excitement aboard the Righteous Wrath, but they were making up in enthusiasm for whatever they lacked in proficiency, and a high old time was being had by all. It was a fine, fresh day, with a faint taste of salt in the breeze from the nearby ocean, at least until our chimeras and transport trucks started up and began farting promethium fumes into the air. We intended to make an impression with our arrival, and by the Emperor we surely did, setting out to march the 10 kloms or so into the city.
Kloms is a Valhallan slang abbreviation for kilometre. Kane served with Valhallan units for most of his life, and almost inevitably his speech became peppered with colloquialisms acquired from them.
Most of the troopers were glad of the exercise, revelling in the fresh air and sunshine after so long between decks, and swung along the highways, lasguns at the slope. Being an old hive boy myself, it was all one to me. But I was affected by the general holiday atmosphere, I think, and I don't mind admitting to a general diffused glow of well-being as we got underway. Castine and Brocklaw couldn't march, of course, having to look grander than the common ground-pounders, and so trundled along at the front of the regiment in a salamander, and I seized the excuse to do the same. Can't have the regiment's most vital officers plotting behind my back, I'd said at the briefing, smiling to show I didn't mean it, and pouring everyone a fresh cup of recaf to show I was part of the team. So I lounged back in the open compartment at the rear of a scout variant, which Jürgen kept half a track's length behind theirs in the interest of protocol, and reinforcing the impression of my generally assumed modesty, and took the opportunity to feel rather pleased with myself. The synchronized slapping of 2,000 boot soles on the surface of the highway and the squawking of the band almost drowned out the throb of our engine, and we must have looked a splendid sight as we left the main cargo gate of the starport behind us and began to approach the city. It was then that my palms began to itch again. There was nothing I could put my finger on initially to explain my gradually intensifying sense of disquiet, but something was definitely tapping my subconscious on the shoulder and whispering, "That's not right." As we entered the city itself, my disquiet grew. I wasn't surprised to find the streets free of traffic, the local authorities having cleared the way for us. 1,000 troopers and their ancillary equipment take up a lot of room, and we were far from the first regiment to have disembarked. Indeed, the occasional muffled curse from behind me, which cut through the din, made it all too clear that the front few ranks would have preferred it if the rough riders could have been held back for a while longer, instead of being sent through immediately ahead of us. Come to that, I don't suppose Castine was too thrilled about having to gaze at a street's width of horse arses for the duration of our march either. But the broad thoroughfares were a little too quiet for my liking, and a little too open as well. I'm not agoraphobic by any means, not like some hivers who never feel comfortable under an open sky, but there was something about those wide streets that made me think of snipers and ambush. That made me scan the buildings as we passed, and my unease grew the more I saw of them. There was nothing wrong with them as such, not like the bizarre architectural forms of a chaos incursion which seemed to twist reality and which hurt to look upon, or the brutal slapdash functionalism of orcish habitations, but there was something in their sweeping forms which seemed vaguely inhuman. I was put in mind of some Eldar architecture by their elegant simplicity. And then it finally hit me. There were no right angles anywhere, even the corners having been rounded and smoothed. But beneath this strange styling, the shapes were clearly those of warehouses, apartment blocks, and manufactoria, as though the whole city had been left out in the sun for too long and had started to melt. That alone should have been enough warning of an insidious alien influence at work here. But before we reached our destination, I was to see far more than that. "There's something seriously wrong here," I said to Jürgen, who looked up briefly from the road ahead to nod in agreement with me. "Something doesn't smell right," he agreed, without a trace of irony. "Have you seen the civilians?" Now that he came to mention it, there were remarkably few of them lining the route. Normally, a big military parade would have brought them out in droves, waving their Aquila flags and their icons of the Divine One, cheering themselves hoarse to see so many of the Emperor's finest ready to see off the foes so they could scuttle back to their meaningless lives without the fear of having to fight for themselves. But the pavements were half empty. And for every shopkeeper or habwife or juvie who cheered and waved, or smiled wanly at us with sidelong glances at their neighbours, there were just as many who scowled or glared at us. That put a shiver down my spine, awakening uncomfortable and all too recent memories of the mess hall riot and the blood-maddened troopers a hair from turning on me. At least no one was shouting or throwing things, yet. But I reached down unobtrusively and loosened my las pistol and my trusty chainsword, ready to be drawn in a hurry if I needed them. And right on cue, I noticed the first of the banners. "Murderers, go home," it said, in shaky capitals, hand-lettered on what looked like an old bedsheet. Someone had strung it from a luminator pole so that it hung out across the street, comfortably above head height, but low enough to brush irritatingly over the head and shoulders of anyone riding in a vehicle. Or on a horse, for that matter. As I watched, one of the Rough Rider officers reached up irritably and tore it down. bad move, I said to myself, expecting some trouble from the crowd. But beyond a little catcalling from a small knot of juvies, nothing happened. But I was getting a distinctly uncomfortable feeling about all of this. There was a perceptible undercurrent of tension in the air now, like a fainter echo of the incipient violence I'd felt aboard the Righteous Wrath. "Go back to your Emperor and leave us alone!" a pretty girl shouted, her head shaven, apart from a single shoulder-length braid. And I felt as though I'd been doused with cold water. "Your Emperor." The words had been unmistakable.
"Heretics," Jürgen said with loathing.
I nodded, still unable to credit it. Could the great enemy have a foothold here as well as the Tau? But common sense argued against it. If that were the case, we'd have bombarded the place from orbit, surely, and the Astartes would have been sent in to cut out the cancer before it could spread. Things weren't as far gone as I'd feared, however. As I turned back to look, a squad of Arbetes forced their way through the crowd and began laying into the juvies with shock buttons. Good order was still being maintained here by the Emperor's grace, but for how much longer? That, I very much feared, depended on us. We reached our staging area without further incident, fanning out through a complex of warehouses and manufactoria which had been set aside for our use. We weren't the only regiment quartered there, I recall, as the Imperium had been fortifying against an expected incursion by the Tau for some time, and I gathered that the Righteous Wrath's complement, 3 full regiments apart from our own, brought the total up to around 30,000 all told. That should have been more than enough to keep a backwater planet even spread out across the whole globe. But rumour had it we could expect still more reinforcement, which worried me more than I wanted to show. With that amount of build-up, it seemed the aliens wanted this place quite badly, and we'd more than likely be expected to hold it the hard way. We were quartered next to one of the Valhallan armoured regiments, the 14th, I think, but I couldn't tell you who most of the others were. There was definite evidence that the Rough Riders were still somewhere in the vicinity there, so you had to watch your feet. But apart from that, I hadn't a clue. Except for one other unit I already knew well, of course, which I'll come to in a moment. I was still feeling spooked from our journey through town, so I was relieved to come across Brocklaw posting sentries around our corner of the compound as I left Jürgen to sort out my quarters and went for a wander around to get my bearings. I haven't reached my second century by not knowing where the best bolt holes and lines of retreat are, and finding them was always a high priority for me whenever I found myself somewhere new. "Good thinking, Major," I complimented him, and he gave me a wry grin. "We should be safe enough here," he said, "but it never hurts to be careful." "I know what you mean," I agreed. "There's something about this place which really gets under my skin." The warehouses around us all had that peculiar rounded-off look I'd noticed before, and the subtle sense of wrongness left a vague apprehension hovering around me like Jürgen's body odour. The Major knew his business, though, setting up lascannon in sandbagged emplacements to cover the gaps between the buildings around us, and sharpshooters on the roof. I was just admiring his thoroughness when the ground began to shake, and a couple of our sentinels appeared, clanking and humming and swivelling their heavy multi-lasers as they took up position in front of the main loading doors, which gave access to the ground floor where our vehicles were parked. Somewhat reassured by this, I made my way across the compound, passing into areas controlled by other units, watching the familiar bustle of troopers coming and going, and finding the familiar air of controlled chaos and the constant background hum of vehicle engines and profanity curiously soothing. I wasn't quite sure how far I'd gone when an engine note both louder and deeper than the others cut through the babble of sound around me. For a moment, I was assailed by that formless sense of recognition that you get when something you once knew so well it never registered consciously comes back to your notice after a passage of years. And then I turned my head with a nostalgic smile. A Trojan heavy hauler, with an Earthshaker howitzer in tow, was growling its way across a vast open area which had probably once been used to park the private vehicles of the workers who toiled here in happier times, but which was now choked with equipment and supplies. I hadn't seen one of those up close in a long time, but I recognised it at once, having started my long and inglorious career in an obscure artillery unit. The flood of memories the sight brought back, a few of them even pleasant, was so overwhelming that for a moment I was unaware of the voice calling my name. Kai! Over here! Now, I've never been what you'd call oversupplied with friends. It goes with the job, I suppose. But of the few I've acquired over the years, only one has ever had the presumption to use the familiar form of my given name. So, despite the changes that the years since I'd seen him last had wrought, there was no mistaking the officer who was running across the compound towards me, grinning like an idiot. Torren! I called back as he sidestepped another Trojan, just in time to avoid being squashed into the tarmac like a bug. When did they make you a major? The last time I'd seen Torren Devis, he'd just been made captain, and was nursing a hangover as he saw me off from the 12th Field Artillery. I remember thinking at the time he was probably the only man in the battery who was sorry to see me go. And what in the name of the Emperor's arse are you doing here? The same as you, I suppose. He came panting up to me, the familiar lopsided grin on his face. Keeping order? Purging the heretics? Same old thing. There were streaks of grey at his temples now, I noticed, and his belt was out another notch, but the same air of boyish enthusiasm still hung around him as on the day we'd first met. But I'm surprised to find you in a backwater like this. Same here, I said. I turned my head, taking in the bustle surrounding us. This seems like an awful lot of firepower to put the frighteners on a bunch of stroppy provincials. If the tower mobilise, we'll need every bit of it, Devis said. Some of their war gear has to be seen to be believed. They've got these things like dreadnoughts, but they're fast, like Astartes infantry, but twice the size. And their tanks make the Eldar stuff look like they were built by orcs. As usual, he seemed to be relishing the prospect of combat, which is easy to do when you're kilometres behind the front line, chucking shells into the distance, but not so much fun when you're facing an enemy close enough to spit at you. And if that's all they've got in mind, think yourself lucky, unless they're one of those emperor-forsaken Xenos that come equipped with venom sacks. But it won't come to that, surely, I said. Now we're here, they'd be mad to attempt a landing. To my astonishment, Devis laughed. They won't have to. They're already here. This was new and unwelcome information, and I goggled at him in surprise. Since when? I gasped. Now, I'd be the first to admit that I'm seldom that diligent when it comes to reading the briefing slates, but I was sure I'd have noticed something that crucial to my well-being in my cursory glance through it. Devis shrugged. About 6 months, apparently. They were already deployed on the planet when the cleansing flame dropped us off here 3 weeks ago. This was seriously bad news. I'd been looking forward to a nice brisk round of target practice on civilian rioters, or, at worst, a turkey shoot against the old renegade PDF unit. But now we were facing a foe that could give us a real run for our money. Emperor's bowels. If half of what I'd heard about the Tau and their techno-sorcery was true, we could be the ones getting our asses kicked. Devis grinned at my expression, misinterpreting it entirely. "So you could see some fun after all," he said, clapping me on the back. I could have killed him. I didn't, of course. For one thing, as I've said, I don't have so many friends that I can afford to waste them. And for another, Devis had been here long enough to pick up some vital information which I currently lacked, namely the location of the nearest bar we could go to without attracting too much attention to ourselves. So we set out through the streets of Mayo together, my commissar's uniform getting us through the guard on the compound gate without any argument, although he did give us a word of caution. "Be careful, sir. There's been disturbances up in the heights, they say."
The heights were the most affluent area of the city, where it began to rise up into the surrounding hills. Though Tau influence on the local architecture was widespread, as Kane notes elsewhere, it was more overt here than anywhere else in Mayo. As a result, it was popular with the most radical of the pro-Tau citizens, and a natural focus of protest for the Imperial loyalists. As the political situation continued to deteriorate, clashes between the two factions became commonplace here.
That meant nothing to me, so I smiled and nodded and said we'd be careful and checked with Devas that we'd be going nowhere near there as soon as we were out of earshot. "Good Emperor, no," he said, frowning. "It's crawling with heretics. The only way you'd catch me up there is with a squadron of hellhounds to cleanse the place." Needless to say, he'd never seen what incendiary weapons can do to a man, or he wouldn't have been half so keen on the idea. "I have, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Actually, there are one or two I would wish it on, come to think of it, and sit there happily toasting carbon nuts while they screamed, but they're all dead now anyway, so it's beside the point." "So where did they all come from?" I asked as we made our way through the streets. Dusk was falling now, the luminators and the cafe signs flickering to life, and the swirl of bodies around us growing thicker as the night descended. Small knots of passers-by stood aside to let us pass, intimidated no doubt by our imperial uniforms and the visible sidearms we carried, some with respect and others resentful. Several of the latter had the curious tonsure the heretic juvie had sported, their heads shaved except for a long scalp lock. The significance of it wasn't to dawn on me until some time later, but even then I realized it was a badge of allegiance of some kind, and that those who bore it were liable to turn traitor if the shooting started. For now, though, they were content merely to mutter insults under their breath. "They're local," Davis said, not deigning to notice them, which was fine by me. Of all the ways I could have ended up dead over the years, getting sucked into a pointless street brawl would have been among the most embarrassing. "The whole planet's infested with Xenolovers." A bit of an exaggeration, that, but he was more or less right, as I was later to discover. To cut a long story short, the Locusts had been trading with the Tau for several generations by now, which wasn't terribly sensible, but what can you expect from a bunch of backwater peasants? The end result was that most of them were quite used to seeing Xenos around the place, and despite the sterling efforts of the local ecclesiarchy to warn them that no good would come of it, a lot of them had started to absorb unhealthy ideas from them, which was where we came in, ready to guide them back into the Imperial fold before they came to too much harm. And all very noble of us, too, I'm sure you'll agree. "The trouble is," Devas concluded, downing the rest of his third Amasek in one, "the Hardcore are so far gone they don't see it like that. They think the Tau the best thing to hit the galaxy since the Emperor was in nappies, and we're the big bad bullies come here to take their shiny new toys away." "Well, that might be a little more difficult now the Tau are digging in," I said, "but I'm surprised they're prepared to risk it." I followed suit, feeling the smoky liquor warming its way down through my chest. "They must know we'll never allow them to annex the place without a fight." "They claim they're just here to safeguard their trading interests," Devas said. We both snorted with laughter at that one. We knew how often the Imperium had said exactly the same thing before launching an all-out invasion of some luckless ball of dirt. Of course, when we did it, it was true, and it was my job to shoot anyone who thought otherwise. "One for the diplomats, then," I said, signalling for another round. A nicely rounded waitress bustled over, full of patriotic fervour, and replenished our glasses. "One thing I can say for Devas, he knew how to find a good bar. This one, the Eagle's Wing, was definitely in the Loyalist camp. The wide, smoky cellar full of Planetary Defence Force regulars were delighted to see some real soldiers at last, and fulminating at the Governor for not letting them loose on the aliens years ago. The owner was a corporal in the PDF Reserves, recently retired after 20 years' service, and he couldn't seem to get over the honour of having a couple of real guard officers in the place. And once Devas introduced me, and I'd been appropriately modest about my earlier adventures in the Emperor's name, there was no question of us having to pay the bill either. After signing autographs for some of the civilian customers, all of whom urged us to pot a few of the little blue bastards on their behalf, and charming the waitress had begun to poll, we'd retreated to a quiet side booth where we could talk uninterrupted. "I think the diplomats could be getting a little help on this one," Devas said, tapping the side of his nose conspiratorially as he lifted the glass. I drank a little more slowly, acutely aware that we'd have to start making our way back through a potentially hostile city soon, and wanting to keep a reasonably clear head. "Help from who?" I asked. Who do you think? Divas dipped his finger in the glass and sketched a stylized letter I with a pair of crossbars bisecting it on the surface of the table before erasing it with a sweep of his hand. I laughed. Oh, yeah, them, right. I've yet to arrive any place where the political situation's fluid without hearing rumours of Inquisition agents beavering away behind the scenes, and unless I happen to be the errand boy in question, I never believe a word of it. On the other hand, if there aren't any rumours, then they probably are up to some mischief and no mistake about it.
A reasonable assumption on both accounts. Details of Kane's subsequent activities as my errand boy, as he puts it, can be found in the Ordo's Librum, if any readers care to check the official accounts. His own version of these events can be found elsewhere in the archive, but need not concern us at the moment.
You can laugh, Divas finished his drink and replaced the glass on the table. But I heard it from one of the Administratum adepts, who swore he'd got it from... somewhere or other. An expression of faint bewilderment drifted across his face. I think I need some fresh air. I think you do too, I said, leaving aside what I thought then were his ridiculous fantasies about the Inquisition. He'd still give me a lot to think about. The situation here was undoubtedly far more complex than I'd been led to believe, and I needed to consider things carefully. So we took our leave of our kindly hosts, the waitress in particular looking sorry to see me go, and staggered up the stairway and into the street. The cold night air hit me like a refreshing shower, snapping me back to alertness, and I glanced around while Divas communed loudly with the Emperor in a convenient gutter. Fortunately, the bar he'd steered us to was down a quiet side alley, so no one saw the dignity of the Imperial uniform being sullied. Once I was sure there were no more eruptions to come, I helped him to his feet. "You used to be able to hold it better than that," I chided, and he shook his head mournfully. "Local rot-gut. Not like the stuff we used to drink. And I should have eaten something." "It would have just been a wasted effort," I consoled him, and glanced around, trying to get our bearings. "Where the frack are we, anyway?" "Dock zone," he said confidently, hardly swaying on his feet at all now. "This way." He strode off towards the nearest illuminated thoroughfare. I shrugged and followed him. After all, he'd had 3 weeks to get his bearings. As we made our way through the well-lit street, however, I began to feel a little apprehensive. True, we'd been deep in conversation on our way to the bar, but none of the landmarks looked familiar to me, and I began to wonder if his confidence had been misplaced. "Torren," I said after a while, noticing a gradual increase in the number of scalp locks and murderous glances amongst the passers-by, "are you sure this is the way back to our staging area?" "Not ours," he said, the grin back on his face. "Theirs. Thought you'd like to get a look at the enemy." "You thought what?" I yelped, amazed at his stupidity. Then I remembered. Divas bought the myth of my purported heroism completely and without question, and had done ever since he'd seen me take on an entire tyrannid swarm with just a chainsword when we were callow youths together. Purely by accident, as it happened. I'd had no idea the damn bugs were even there until I'd blundered into them, and if I hadn't ended up inadvertently leading them into the beaten zone of our heavy ordnance and saving the day, they'd have torn me to pieces. Waltzing up to the enemy encampment and thumbing our noses at them probably struck him as the kind of thing I did for fun. "Are you out of your mind?" "It's perfectly safe," he said. "We're not officially at war with them yet." Well, that was true, but I still wasn't keen on jumping the gun. "And until we are, we're not going to provoke them," I said, all commissarial duty. Diva's face fell like a child denied a sweet, and I thought I'd better put a gloss on it that would match his expectations of me. "We can't put our own amusement ahead of our responsibilities to the Emperor, however tempting it is." "I suppose you're right," he said reluctantly. I began to breathe a little more easily. Now all I had to do was manoeuvre him back to the barracks before he got any more stupid ideas. So I took him by the arm and turned him around. "Now, how do we get back to our compound?"
"How about in a body bag?"
somebody asked. I turned, feeling my stomach drop. About a dozen locals stood behind us, the streetlights striking highlights from their shaven heads, a variety of improvised weapons hanging purposefully from their hands. They looked tough, at least in their own minds, but when you've been face to face with orcs and Eldar Reaver slavers, you don't intimidate that easily. Well, all right, I do, but I don't show it, which is the main thing. Besides, I had a las pistol and a chainsword, which in my experience trumps a crowbar every time. So I laid a restraining hand on Divas's shoulder, as he was still intoxicated enough to rise to the bait, and smiled lazily. "Believe me," I said, "you don't want to start anything."
"You don't tell me what I want."
The group spokesman stepped forward into the light. "Fine," I thought. "Keep them talking."
"But that's what you Imperials do, isn't it?"
"I don't quite follow," I said, affecting mild curiosity. Movement out of the corner of my eye told me that our retreat had been cut off. A second group emerged from the alley mouth behind us. I started calculating the odds. If I made a move to draw the las pistol, they'd rush me, but I'd probably manage to get a shot off. If I took out the leader with it and ran forward at the same time, I stood a chance of breaking through the line and making a run for it. That assumed they'd be surprised or intimidated enough to hesitate, of course, and I was able to open up a decent lead. With any luck, they'd turn on Divas, buying me enough time to get away, but I couldn't be sure of that. So I continued to play for time and look for a better chance.
"You're here to take our world!" the leader shouted.
As he came forward fully into the light, I could see that his face was painted blue, a delicate pastel shade. It should have made him look ridiculous, but the overall effect was somehow charismatic.
"But you'll never take our freedom!"
"Your freedom is what we're here to give you, you Xeno-hugging moron!" Divas broke free of my restraining arm and lunged forward.
"But you're too brainwashed to see it!"
Great. So much for diplomacy. Still, while he was set on reenacting Gannak's charge, I might be able to make a run for it.
Gannak's charge was a famous military blunder in the Spiron campaign, which took place on 438.926.M41. Captain Gannak's sentinel troop from the 3rd Kalaman Hussars misinterpreted their orders and charged an orc redoubt containing an artillery battery. No one survived.
No such luck, of course. The surrounding heretics drove in on us as a concerted wedge. I just managed to draw my las pistol and snap off a shot, taking out half the face of one of the group, which, I'm bound to say, didn't make much of a difference to his overall personal charm, before an iron bar came down hard on my wrist. I've been in enough melees to have seen the blow coming, and to have ridden it, which saved me from a fracture or worse, but that didn't help the pain, which exploded along my arm, deadening it. My fingers flew open and I ducked, scrabbling after the precious weapon, but it was futile. A knee drove up into my ribs, slamming the breath from my lungs, and I was down. Cold, hard rockcrete scraping the skin from my knuckles, or the real ones anyway, and knowing I was a dead man unless I could get away somehow.
"Torren!"
I screamed. But Divas had problems of his own by now, and I wasn't going to get any help from that quarter. I curled up, trying to protect my vital organs, and tried frantically to get at my chainsword. Of course, I should have gone for that first, holding the mob at bay with it, but hindsight's about as much use as a heretic's oath, and now the bloody thing was trapped under my own body weight. I scrabbled frantically, feeling fists and boots thudding against my ribs. Luckily, there were so many of them that they were getting in each other's way, and my uniform greatcoat was thick enough to absorb some of the impact, or I'd have been in even worse shape than I was.
"Gritcha!"
Something shrieked, an inhuman scream that raised the hairs on the back of my neck, even under those conditions. My assailants hesitated, and I rolled clear, in time to see the largest of them yanked back by sheer brute force. For a moment I thought I was hallucinating, but the pain in my ribs was all too real. A face, dominated by a large, hooked beak, was gazing down at me, surmounted by a crest of quills that had been dyed or painted in some elaborate pattern, and hot charnel breath washed across my face, making me gag.
"You are comparatively uninjured,"
the thing asked, in curiously accented Gothic. It's hard to convey in writing, but its voice was glottal, most of the consonants reduced to hard clicking sounds. It was perfectly understandable, mind you.
My stupefaction was due entirely to the fact that something that looked like that was able to talk in the first place.
"Yes, thank you," I croaked after a moment.
"Whenever you don't have a clue what's going on, I've always found it never hurts to be polite."
"That is gratifying," the thing said, and threw the heretic in its left hand casually away.
The others were standing around aimlessly now, like sulky scholar students, when the tutor turns up to spoil the fun. Then it extended the same thin, scaly hand equipped with dagger-like claws towards me. After a heart-stopping moment, I divined its intention and accepted the proffered assistance in gaining my feet. As I did so, it turned to the sullen group of heretics.
"This does not advance the greater good," it said. "Disperse now, and avoid conflict."
Well, that was a challenge if ever I'd heard one. But to my surprise, and I must admit my intense relief, the little knot of troublemakers slunk away into the shadows. I eyed my rescuer a little apprehensively. He, or she, with Crute it's impossible to tell, and only another Crute would care anyway, was slightly taller than I was, and still looked pretty intimidating. They're tough enough to take on an orc in hand-to-hand combat, and I, for one, wouldn't be betting on the greenskin. But if it wanted me dead, it would only have had to wait a few moments. I retrieved my fallen las pistol anyway, and tried to get my breath back.
"I'm obliged to you," I said. "I must admit I don't understand, but I'm grateful."
I fumbled the weapon back into its holster with some difficulty. My arm was swelling up now, and my fingers felt thick and unresponsive. My rescuer made a curious clicking sound, which I assumed to be its equivalent of laughter.
"Imperial officers murdered by Tau supporters, not a desirable outcome when the political situation is tense."
"Not a desirable outcome at any time when one of them is me," I said, and the Xeno made the clicking noise again. That reminded me of Devis, and I staggered across to check on him. He was still breathing, but unconscious, a deep gash across his forehead. I'd picked up enough battlefield medicine to know he'd recover soon enough, but have the Emperor's own headache when he woke up. And that was fine with me. Served the idiot right for nearly getting me killed.
"I have the honour to be Krook of the Clan T'Char,"
the creature said.
"I am Krut."
"I know what you are," I said. "Krut killed my parents, and thereby got me dumped in the Scholar Progenium, and thence into the Commissariat, instead of following my undoubted true destiny of running some discreet little house of ill repute for slumming spirers and guilders up from the sump with more money than sense to splash around. I vaguely resented that, far more than the loss of my progenitors, who hadn't been all that much to have around while they were alive, to be honest. But it never hurts to grab the moral high ground. My new acquaintance didn't seem terribly concerned, though.
"I trust they fought well," he said.
I doubted it. They'd only joined the guard to get out of the hive ahead of the Arbetes, and would certainly have deserted the first chance they got, so there must be something in genetics after all.
"Not well enough," I said, and Gorok clicked his amusement again.
It was a slightly unnerving experience, feeling that something so unhuman was able to read me more readily than my own people.
"Go carefully, Commissar," he said. "And feed on your enemies. May we have no cause for conflict."
Well, thank the Emperor for that. But somehow I doubted that it was going to happen. And of course I was right. I was surprised, though, by how quickly the crisis came upon us.
Editorial note. It is perhaps worth pointing out at this juncture that the account of his background that Kane gives during his conversation with the Krut, although superficially plausible, doesn't quite hold together on further examination. For one thing, admittance to the Scholar Progenium is a privilege, usually reserved for the offspring of officers. If he was indeed the son of common troopers, his parents must have acquitted themselves with singular valour in the action which resulted in their demise, which, to say the least, seems remarkably at odds with his characterization of them. Moreover, he implies that they enlisted and served together. Although mixed units are, as pointed out elsewhere, not unheard of in the Imperial Guard, it would have been extremely unusual for this to have been the case. Cain makes frequent references throughout the archive to having spent his early years on a hive world, but never specifies which one, which in turn makes the verification of any such claims virtually impossible. However, no hive world of which I'm aware raised a mixed guard regiment in the time frame consistent with his narrative. We should also bear in mind that, by his own admission, the man was a pathological liar. Given to